The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting in the food section with designer Layla Rose Does Happy Hour. These ideas from her new entertaining book get their beauty from a single star ingredient. Give us a beat. Designer Layla Rose's new book, Fresh Air Affairs, is an ode to outdoor entertaining, and just like the Texas native's famously exuberant clothes, each gathering she's created pops with joy and personality. This patio-friendly menu gets its flavor and palate from beets in various forms, and the appetizers can be made ahead. Fizzy drinks, antioxidant-rich snacks, and summer breeze? You and your guests will be in the pink. Roasted red beet hummus makes about 2 cups. Serve with assorted baby vegetables and chips. 1 16-ounce can of chickpeas, drained and rinsed. 2 medium roasted red beets, peeled and cut into pieces. 2/3 of a cup of tahini. 2 tablespoons of lemon zest. 1/3 cup fresh lemon juice, plus more if needed. 2 garlic cloves. 1 teaspoon of cumin. 1 teaspoon of salt. 1/3 cup extra virgin olive oil, plus more for serving, thinly sliced radish, toasted pine nuts, chopped fresh Italian parsley. Combine the chickpeas, beets, tahini, lemon zest and juice, garlic, cumin, and salt in a food processor and pulse several times until finely chopped. With the motor running, slowly add the olive oil and blend until smooth. Season to taste with additional salt and lemon juice if necessary. Can be prepared up to 4 days ahead, covered and refrigerated. Transfer the hummus to a shallow bowl and drizzle with olive oil and garnish with radish slices, pine nuts, and parsley. Beet Rose Cocktail makes 10. 1 750-milliliter bottle of lemon-flavored vodka. 2.5 cups of purchased fresh beet juice. 1 cup of lemon juice. Honey or simple syrup to taste. Ice cubes. Mint sprigs for garnish, 1 to 2 750-milliliter bottles of Prosecco. Stir the vodka, beet juice, and lemon juice to combine in a large beverage dispenser. Add ice to fill and a few mint sprigs. To serve, fill the glasses with ice, add enough of the vodka mixture to fill the glass halfway, pour in enough Prosecco to fill the glass to the top, and garnish with mint sprigs. Fancy Pants Ants on a Log. Ants on a Log doesn't have to be kindergarten fare. Why not Fancy Pants? These ants with goat cheese, pine nuts, freshly snipped herbs, and a rainbow of rondelle sliced vegetables. The brighter the better. In wellness, we have Sudden Menopause, a Survival Guide. Certain medical events, such as cancer or ectopic pregnancy and their treatments, can catapult you into the change of life without warning. A leading menopause expert lays out both hormone and hormone-free options. Women experience sudden menopause for a variety of reasons. They include having chemotherapy or radiation treatments for cancer, which can cause ovarian failure, dysfunction, or surgical loss of both ovaries during procedures related to ectopic pregnancy, endometriosis, ovarian cyst removal, or ovarian cancer. Sometimes the onset of sudden menopause happens when women decide to have both of their ovaries removed in order to reduce their risk of breast and ovarian cancer if they have the BRCA1 BRCA or BRCA2 BRCA2 gene mutations or other high-risk gene mutations or Lynch syndrome. In these instances, the result is often referred to as risk-reducing surgical menopause. In each of these instances, a woman doesn't go through perimenopause, the gradual transition when hormone levels wax and wane until her final period. Instead, Menopause is foisted upon her, and the rapid loss of hormones often causes more intense symptoms than those that occur with a gradual downshifting. Sometimes sudden menopause has an intense psychological component too, because women who experience it may have recently learned that they have cancer or a high risk of cancer, or have undergone harsh treatment for cancer. All of these scenarios can be incredibly stressful, physically and emotionally, and lead women to feel at odds with their bodies. When a woman experiences sudden menopause, she may get a surprising and often rapid flood of symptoms such as hot flashes, night sweats, mood swings, mental fogginess, vaginal dryness, and decreased sex drive. In fact, loss of libido is often more pronounced after surgical menopause than it is with natural menopause. Any or all of these symptoms can affect quality of life, including sexual desire and functionality due to vaginal atrophy when vaginal tissues become thinner and drier due to the loss of estrogen. And if a woman with sudden menopause has undergone chemotherapy or radiation or taken other medications such as aromatase inhibitors or selective estrogen receptor modulators, SERMs, like tamoxifen, to treat her cancer, those treatments may have further altered the pH level of the vagina, which can exacerbate these symptoms. It's a distressing double whammy. What follows are two baseline treatment plans for sudden menopause types. The first focuses on the use of hormone therapy, HT. The second is hormone-free. Discuss with your doctor what makes sense for you, and if you don't get relief, speak up. Plan A, a hormone therapy. For women with sudden menopause who want to use hormone therapy and don't have any contradictions to HT1, recommend the use of transdermal estrogen, either applying Divigel, estradiol gel, to the upper thigh every morning after showering or wearing a transdermal patch to treat hot flashes and night sweats. The estrogen is also likely to help with vaginal dryness, brain fog, and joint aches and pains. The goal is for women to have blood levels of estrogen between 40 and 70 pg/ml, though they could be higher if she's under age 45. There are two primary reasons I prefer transdermal estrogen for women with sudden menopause. Many of these women are recovering from surgery, and transdermal estrogen has been shown to have a lower risk of blood clots compared to oral estrogen formulations. Second, for women who have high-risk genetic mutations for breast cancer, there's some data that transdermal estrogen confers a slightly lower risk for breast changes. If a woman with sudden menopause still has her uterus and is taking estrogen, she needs to take 100 milligrams of oral progesterone in the form of micronized natural progesterone, Prometrium, at bedtime nightly. This should be increased to 200 milligrams if she's using a greater than 0.5 milligrams of Divigel daily, or a 0.05 milligram estradiol patch. Progesterone protects the uterus from experiencing overgrowth of the lining and possibly the development of uterine cancer while taking estrogen therapy. If a woman no longer has her uterus, she doesn't need progesterone. Alternatively, using a progesterone-releasing IUD, which can stay in place for 7 years, offers the added benefit of not needing to titrate the dose of progesterone if a woman changes her estrogen dosage. An extra bonus, if a woman is considering having an IUD inserted, she can often do it at the time of whatever surgery she's having. I also recommend using vaginal prastatone, a form of DHEA, as a nightly suppository. Once inside the cells, the prastatone is converted into estrogens and androgens, which are beneficial for the genital tissue in someone who was essentially shocked into menopause. These hormones don't travel systematically throughout the body. Plan B, non-hormonal treatment. For some sudden menopause types, there are clear contraindications to using systemic hormone therapy. If you've had an estrogen-positive breast cancer, for example, others may not want to use hormone therapy for personal reasons. but there's no reason to suffer silently or needlessly. For vaginal dryness and irritation, I recommend using non-hormonal hyaluronic acid suppositories, such as Sweet Spot Labs Rescue Balm, Mia Vita from Femme Pharma, or a product from Rosebud Woman. Every night, depending on additional symptoms, here are other possible treatments. Lexapro is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSR1, antidepressant that can blunt hot flashes. When it's taken at night, it can help with mood, both depression and anxiety, and trouble sleeping. Other options include the antidepressants Celexa and Paxil. Some sudden menopause types may be taking tamoxifen, a hormonal therapy used to treat breast cancer, which interacts with many SSRIs. Lexapro, Effexor, and Pristique are less problematic than many others when used in conjunction with tamoxifen. Another possibility, if the woman is not taking tamoxifen, is the SSR1 Brisdel 7.5 milligrams, which is the only non-hormonal medication approved by the FDA to treat hot flashes. It can be used with aromatase inhibitors, a class of drugs used to treat breast cancer and postmenopausal women. If a woman doesn't want to take an SSRI, alternatives for relieving hot flashes include taking 100 to 300 milligrams at night of gabapentin, an anti-seizure drug often used for nerve pain, or 5 milligrams of oxybutynin, that's oxybutynin, typically used for overactive bladder once or twice a day. For now, libido, sleep troubles, and mood issues, a woman can take a DADDYI, also known as flibanserin, an FDA-approved prescription medication for hypoactive sexual desire disorder, including low libido in pre- and postmenopausal women. The drug increases dopamine in the brain, which has a mood-enhancing effect, and when taken at night, it can produce a sense of relaxation for better sleep. In culture and news, Serena Williams jokes about her growing baby bump in new post. I am seriously trying to figure out if the baby's in the front or back. Serena Williams joked about her curvy body in a funny new Instagram post showing off her baby bump. The tennis champion shared two photos of herself posing in a black column dress inside a luxurious venue in Italy, a large outdoor space adorned with white flowers and chairs and hanging vines. The strapless dress perfectly hugged Williams' body, including her belly and her backside, causing her to write, "Caution, things are not always how they appear. I am seriously trying to figure out if the baby is in the front or back. Slide right." Williams paired the little black dress with chunky pink-heeled sandals, silver hoop earrings, and a diamond necklace. She wore her hair slicked back and opted for a dark, smoky eye. Her latest baby bump snap comes weeks after she revealed she is expecting her second child with husband Alexis Ohanian at the 2023 Met Gala. At the same time, she walked the carpeted steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in a fabulous black and white custom Gucci gown and happily cradled her bump for the cameras. A YouTube video released on the Tennis Pros channel last week showed the moment before the gala when Williams and Ohanian told daughter Alexis Olympia Ohanian the news that she would become a big sister. "Oh my God, I'm so excited," the 5-year-old says repeatedly in the clip, hugging her mom. Williams revealed her wish to have another child in an emotional essay last year, announcing her retirement from professional tennis. "I'm here to tell you that I'm evolving away from tennis toward other things that are important to me. A few years ago, I quietly started Serena Ventures, a venture capital firm. Soon after that, I started a family. I want to grow that family," she wrote at the time. Still in news, The View fans are commenting nonstop on Whoopi Goldberg's new career announcement. The Sister Act star is adding another book to her impressive literary catalog. Whoopi Goldberg is taking her talents from daytime TV and expanding them in a whole new way. The View star makes a name for herself each weekday when she hits the table on the ABC talk show. But, as she recently shared on Instagram, the 67-year-old actress is co-writing a new graphic novel called The Change, published by Dark Horse Comics, the media company behind the Umbrella Academy books that inspired the hit Netflix series. What's more, folks can now pre-order The Change online ahead of its November 28th release. A new kind of hero is coming to Dark Horse Comics, courtesy of Whoopi Goldberg, who is co-writing The Change, a graphic novel about an older superhero, read the caption of the Instagram post. Goldberg later added a comment about the project. I made this for every woman over a certain age who still knows that somewhere inside her is a superhero with a saggy chest and a big behind who can still kick. When the ghost actress followers saw the post, they immediately congratulated her in the comments section. I'm not even a comic book fan, but this piqued my interest, one person wrote on Instagram. Yes, the world needs more older superheroes. Give me a tough-as-nails granny over yet another reluctant teen any day. A different user replied, oh, this is going to be good, another follower agreed. While Goldberg gave folks a brief overview of The Change online, Dark Horse Comics provided a better clue into the book's premise in an official press release. According to Dark Horse, the graphic novel will center around Isabel Frost, a woman who spent her life dedicated to family. But she also has a love for video games, which she starts to play thanks to her comic book-obsessed grandson and her best friend. As she embraces a new identity online, she learns how it will change her life forever. Additionally, The Change will be the sister act star's first venture into picture books that aren't geared toward children. Goldberg has previously published the kid-friendly Sugar Plum Ballerina series. The sixth book of the franchise was released this past January. Portions of this article were edited due to time. This next article is entitled Zarna Garg's New Stand-Up Special is a Family Affair. With one in a billion, Garg mines humor from her life as a New York City immigrant mom. With Zarna Garg's three children pushed her to consider a career in comedy, the former lawyer has been a stay-at-home mom for 16 years. As an immigrant from Mumbai, India, Garg wasn't even convinced that stand-up could be a real job. But her first gig at a New York City open mic in 2018 set her on a new trajectory. I just started ranting about my family and my kids, and people were dying from laughter, and I couldn't understand what was happening, Garg recalls. I had to go home and Google what is a joke, because I didn't even know that. A few short years and a pandemic later, Garg has channeled her innate comedic chops into a massive TikTok presence. 705,000 followers, and sold out shows at clubs across North America. Branding herself on social media as the Funny Brown Mom, she posts videos often from her kitchen, frequently while cutting up pineapple and usually while telling her kids no one they ask her permission to do something fun. While her debut hour-long special One in a Billion premiering on Prime Video on May 16, Garg is poised to win over a wider audience with her side-splitting observations on everything, from arranged marriage to hot yoga to bubble baths. In India, you get water in bucket. There's buckets in America too, but they're filled with fried chicken. A lot of your stand-up encompasses your everyday life and family dynamics. How did you originally test the waters for talking about your husband and kids on stage? It was very natural. I guess no one in my family expected my career to be what it has become. We all thought I'd do a few open mics and then that would be it. Instead, each thing just became a bigger thing and a bigger thing, and it just kept growing. I realized, oh, if I say funny things about my husband, it is making 10,000 other women feel like that's their life. So, knowing what it became, my whole family was on board. And also, I mean, supported them unquestionably for 16 years, so they owed me. Some of your material leans into stereotypes of Indian parents being strict and raising kids to be overachievers. But your own story breaks from a traditional path. How do these contradictions play out in your life? People do ask me, how can I be so strict and old-fashioned about my kids when I myself am a comedian? I'll be honest with you. In an ideal world, I would be a software engineer. In my head, I should have been that Google billionaire, but I'm not. Destiny had a different path for me, and I think that these contradictions are reason that my audience resonates with me so much. We've all thought we were going to do something, but it ended up another way. Or our parents had one dream, we had another dream, and it was a messy road to get wherever we got. When you were starting this new career, did you have any specific heroes? I came from a world where we don't really consume stand-up comedy. Of course, I watched Russell Peters growing up, but I never imagined that I would be somebody who could do that. I had never stepped foot in a comedy club before, and that's true for a lot of Indians today. My audiences are overwhelmingly people who have never stepped foot in a comedy club. So I watched all the big comedy specials out of curiosity to see what were people joking about. Then I started watching more female comics. I loved Ellen DeGeneres' stand-up set. I knew her as a talk show host. I never knew she was a stand-up comic. I looked up Roseanne Barr's late-night set. And once you go down that rabbit hole, it's endless. Hasan Minhaj's, and that's M-I-N-H-A-J, first comedy special. Then things started falling into place in my mind about where I could fit in. You start off your stand-up special talking about the immigrant experience. You left India as a teenager to avoid an arranged marriage that your widowed father had set up. What were some of your first impressions of America as a new arrival? I moved to Akron, Ohio. My sister lives there even now. I thought it was a very calm and quiet place, because I was coming from the hustle and bustle of Mumbai. Everybody was super kind and super warm, warm as people, but cold as a place to visit. But my overall impressions were nothing but amazing, and that's part of why every show I do, it's my desire to make American people feel good about themselves, to remind them why people like me come here. The American psyche has taken such a hit in the last decade or so. There's a lot of, we suck, we don't do this right, we don't do that right. No one's perfect, and there's a lot of room for improvement. But speaking as somebody who lived in much harsher environments, I feel like I'm in a position to remind Americans how great they are. Something so special about being in America is you can get up on stage and be critical of anybody and anything, and that's okay. How did you manage to go from New York City open mics and clubs to touring as a headliner and then taping a special in just a few years. I came into comedy with complete clarity that I'm doing this as a business. I was looking to re-enter the workforce at a time when I feel like women have been most beaten down by the pandemic, especially the moms. It's like the pandemic gave me a renewed sense of I have to fight this fight. Because so many of my mom friends got thrown out of whatever jobs they were doing. Even many of my doctor mom friends got crushed out of work. I was like, if the audience does not like me, I accept it, and I will move on. And to be honest, I wouldn't have had the luxury. What club was going to book me if I wasn't killing consistently? No one is out there looking for a 48-year-old mom, Indian with an accent. I knew that I would have to prove myself at multiple levels higher than the average comic just to even stay in the game. But I was okay with that high bar. It showed that there was room for real business. If you have a very strong set and you are able to answer a few questions, who is the audience? How are you going to tap into that audience? You have the case to either go to a streaming service or go to a producer who is familiar with how streaming services work. In my case, I didn't go to them. They found me because they heard the buzz. If every club I book is reporting sold-out shows and added shows, they sit up and they take note. Now that you are selling out shows across North America, what are some memorable moments you've had with fans? I'll tell you one moment. At an Indian wedding where I was hired to perform, a whole lineup of elderly Indian people were waiting to meet me after my set. A few of them had tears in their eyes and said, "We have lived in America 50, 60 years, and we have laughed at things we don't understand. For the first time, we enjoyed something that we completely understood, and thank you for bringing this world to our world." That night, I really went home and wept because I didn't go into any of this thinking that I'm doing something big. I really didn't. I was just trying to find a job and put something good out there. I did lots of free first responder shows during the pandemic because I would get messages from doctors, nurses, like, "We just need something to lighten up our day." And I would go and do a show, wear a mask, whatever it took. I've held hands with people whose relatives have told me, "This person's not going to make it much longer, but we want them to smile today." That's the heavy part of what I do. It's a reminder to me that I have a bigger purpose than just making jokes. I take it very seriously. What are you most proud of about this special, which is bringing your stand-up act to a global audience? What I'm doing is so unheard of for brown women everywhere in the world. There are entire countries where women don't watch my videos openly. They watch them in hiding. Because, culturally, a woman who's going to make fun of her husband, her kids, her mother-in-law, it's not okay in that culture. With this special, I'm trying to break a lot of barriers, not just in America. I'm just about getting the word out and getting eyeballs. It's about making millions of women in the world believe that they have a right to laugh at their life, and that it's okay for them to participate in this art form. They're not committing a crime. You bring your family on stage at the end of the special, which is so unique. Talk about that decision and what went into filming it. In addition to my stand-up career is my digital career, my TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter accounts, where I do a lot of home videos. My kids and my husband are participants, so it only felt fitting that if I'm going to talk about them for an hour, and you guys may know them from all these other platforms, that they should be part of this moment in the special. Without them, I wouldn't be here. And without them, I wouldn't have the stories and the jokes that I have. And honestly, they're a good-looking bunch, wouldn't you say? Absolutely. Were you picking your kids' clothes when you were getting ready for the taping? Honestly, I was so crazed that I didn't. I put my husband in charge, and then the day of, I was like, "Oh my God, not a green shirt." My husband was in shock. He's like, "There's a lot involved in picking kids' clothes." And I said, "Yes, yes, sir. Thank you for getting involved for the first time in 2 decades. In the beauty section, we have an article, "New Research Finds the Reason Behind Gray Hair and How It Could Be Preventable." Experts explain how your silver strands may be reversible. We've always thought that gray hair is inevitable, but is it? New research shows that silver strands may actually be preventable and reversible. A study published in Nature focused on cells in the skin of mice that are also found in humans, called melanocyte stem cells. The main mechanism that produces melanin, the substance that produces hair, skin, and eye pigmentation. Over time, as hair ages, sheds, and grows back, melanocyte stem cells may eventually stop moving like they used to, failing to reach the part of the process where pigment is created and hair color developed. These cells get stuck as people age in what's called the hair follicle bulge. This leads to the cells losing their ability to mature and maintain hair color, which leads to hair becoming gray, silver, and the like. In this new study, researchers proved that this hair follicle bulge happens and determined that moving melanocyte stem cells to their proper location where they continue to mature and generate pigment could prevent graying. Our study adds to our basic understanding of how melanocyte stem cells work to color hair, study lead investigator Qi-Sun, that's Qi-Sun, a postdoctoral fellow at NYU Langen Health, said in press release. The newfound mechanisms raise the possibility that the same fixed positioning of melanocyte stem cells may exist in humans. If so, it presents a potential pathway for reversing or preventing the graying of human hair by helping jammed cells to move again between developing hair follicle compartments. If you aren't looking to fend off the grays, there are plenty of people also in that camp that embrace their silver strands, take Andy McDowell and Helen Mirren, for example, but you'll still want to pay attention to this study as it actually shows promise in another area, cancer. Melanocytes are also the cell types that proliferate uncontrollably in melanoma, a dangerous skin cancer. Oma Ogbe, MD, board-certified dermatologist and director of Multicultural Dermatology and Hair Loss Disorders at the UC Davis Medical Center, notes, "We are interested in how stem cells residing in our body are regulated to properly maintain our body and how they can reform the tissues when they are lost by injuries." Mayumi Ito, a professor at NYU Langen Health and a senior investigator on the study, told NPR, "When the stem cell regulation goes awry, we will have multiple health problems, including cancers," she told the outlet. "The melanocyte stem cells system is advantageous to understand this broad issue in medical science, as the malfunction of the system is so visible." Wait, why does hair go gray? Hair does not actually change color once it has grown out of the follicle. However, as new hair grows from aging follicles, the pigment cells become less active over time and are less likely to produce pigment in older people, says Rebecca Marcus, MD, board-certified dermatologist with North Dallas Dermatology Associates. "This usually happens gradually and most often begins after age 35. But these stem cells aren't the only factor. Genetics play a big part in the age at which someone begins to go gray, and silver strands are often age-related," says Dr. Marcus. "In some cases, though, a medical condition such as a thyroid disorder, neurofibromatosis, vitamin B12 deficiency, or vitiligo may cause hair to gray prematurely." Studies have also shown that oxidative stress caused by environmental factors such as UV radiation, pollution, and even emotional stress can lead to premature failure of melanocytes within hair follicles, Dr. Marcus adds, aka going gray at an early age. The bottom line: this study suggests that the differentiated melanocyte stem cells can receive signals to move backward in their development into differentiated stem cells, says Dr. Ogbai. When a new stem cells are developed, they proceed to differentiate into more pigment-producing cells, which can lead to new melanin production of the hair and subsequent pigmentation of the hair, Dr. Ogbai explains. If this can be replicated in live humans, it may be possible to repigment hair that has been depigmented, meaning reversing gray hair. While this new revelation can be exciting for those who prefer their original hue, the research still has a way to go before you can count on preventing or reversing grays. Human safety data must be proven and FDA approved before such medications can be used safely, Dr. Ogbe notes. So take these findings with a grain of salt and pepper. But it is exciting, as there is evidence that depigmentation of hair leading to graying may be at least partially reversible, says Dr. Ogbai. The cited study is a basic science study done in a lab, so we may be far from clinical trials in humans that prove that there is a drug that can reverse hair graying. At the end of the day, there's no quick fix. Yet. So be wary of any miracle drug that claims to restore your colored hair. Be careful about any non-FDA-approved medications or supplements claiming to reverse hair graying by potentiating melanocyte stem cells, says Dr. Ogbai. And in the meantime, if you're looking to make the most of your grays, check out some of the best shampoos for gray hair. In culture and news, this article is entitled, "Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter Has Dementia, Is Living Happily at Home with Husband Jimmy Carter." We hope sharing our family's news will increase important conversations at kitchen tables and in doctor's offices around the country. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has dementia, the Carter family confirmed today. The Carter family is sharing that former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has dementia. She continues to live happily at home with her husband, enjoying spring in Plains and visits with loved ones, reads a statement shared on the Carter Center's website. Rosalyn, 95, lives in Plains, Georgia, with her husband, former President Jimmy Carter, 98. In February, Jimmy entered hospice care but remains in good spirits, according to his grandson. The Carter family noted that Rosalyn has been the nation's leading mental health advocate for much of her life. First in the Georgia governor's mansion, then in the White House, and later at the Carter Center. She urged improved access to care and decreased stigma about issues surrounding mental health. They also shared that 1 in 10 older Americans have dementia and that there's stigma around getting support. We recognize, as she did more than half a century ago, that stigma is often a barrier that keeps individuals and their families from seeking and getting much-needed support, the Carter family wrote. We hope sharing our family's news will increase important conversations at kitchen tables and in doctors' offices around the country. The statement ended, "As the founder of the Rosalyn Carter Institute for Caregivers, Mrs. Carter often noted that there are only 4 kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregivers. The university of caregiving is clear in our family. The universality of caregiving is clear in our family, and we are experiencing the joy and challenges of this journey." Just last week, Rosalyn and Jimmy's grandson, Jason Carter, shared of his grandparents, "Their faith is really grounding in this moment. In that way, it's as good as it can be." The Carter family said they do not expect to comment further on Rosalyn's health. This article is "Fashion Designer Aurora James Talks Blooming in Unexpected Places." The author, fashion designer, and founder of the 15% Pledge, opens up about her poignant new memoir, Wildflower. Designer, activist, disruptor. These are just a few of the words often used to describe Aurora James. The Toronto native and New York City transplant is the founder and creative director of the celebrity-adored luxury accessories brand Brother Vellies, which she launched in 2013. At the root of the brand is a deeply important ethos and mission. It aims to keep traditional African design practices and techniques alive while also creating and sustaining artisanal jobs. Through its handmade offerings, so beloved is her work that James became the first Black female designer to win a Council of Fashion Designers of America award. She was also elected to be a vice chair of the CFDA in December 2022. With so much success and adorations for what she created, it would have been easy for James to keep her head down and focus on continuing to grow her own brand. But in 2020, after the killing of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, James felt called to champion other Black-owned businesses. So she founded the 15% Pledge with the goal of getting big corporations to dedicate 15% of their shelf space to Black-owned brands. What began as a call to action on Instagram in May 2020, she tells Oprah Daily, is now the largest driver for Black American entrepreneurs that this country has ever seen. Retailers like Nordstrom, Sephora, and Macy's have jumped on board, funneling billions of dollars to Black-owned businesses. Simply put, James started a revolution. Now, James has released a memoir, Wildflower, which shows you exactly how she became the force she is today. The book traces pivotal moments and painful challenges, including childhood sexual abuse and an eating disorder she experienced while living or traveling in places like Canada, Jamaica, and Africa, plus what she learned as her career gave way to the activism we know her for today. Here she tells us a bit more about the journey. What inspired you to write this memoir? Social media has done such a specific thing to women. While everything just seems so perfect all the time and life just comes together for people, And I know my life was not like that at all. I realized in talking to so many young people that they felt like my life might have been that way, and that in some ways then it would preclude them from being successful in the way they could be because they felt like they didn't go to the right school or they didn't get the right grades. I obviously didn't go to the right school or get the right grades or even finish any school. I thought it would be helpful to put my own story out there so people could see parts of themselves also in my journey and understand that they're exactly where they need to be in order to make a change in the world. How did you choose the title Wildflower? My mom used to make seed bombs with me when I was a little girl, a little kid. You take seeds and put it in clay and dirt and roll them into a ball. When we would go on drives, if we saw an abandoned piece of land or somewhere that looked like it had been forgotten, we would throw these seed bombs at them, and we would yell, "Seed bomb!" And we'd just know that a couple weeks later, there'd be a whole huge patch of really beautiful wildflowers in its place. She used to always say to me, like, make sure your bloom is in unexpected places. Make sure you show up entirely as yourself, even when the environment doesn't really support that sort of thing as it is now. And make sure you look at everything that maybe is a little lackluster as an opportunity for growth and an opportunity to add more beauty into the world. And so that's really what it's about. When you take the jacket off the book, there's a poem that is a favorite of mine that says, "You can cut all the flowers, but you can't keep spring from coming." And that's how I feel about so many of us in this country and in this world right now, who are really confidently pushing for change, acceptance, and growth. You say that being a biracial child much of your early life revolved around straddling two cultures. Looking back, what superpower do you think that gave you? I think I actually straddled three different cultures, because I lived in Jamaica as well, and that was a totally new environment. The Caribbean is so much different than even Canada or even Africa, and it was really fascinating for me, who had an African father living in Jamaica, because everyone would assume that I was Caribbean. Understanding the nuances within blackness and even whiteness has been a superpower of mine, truly. In America, so often, as people of color, we're sort of thought of as being monolithic, when there are so many unique experiences that rest within that shade or dome blackness. There are so many different things that can be encapsulated in that dome. Being able to look at situations and ideas from multiple lenses is my superpower. You talk a lot about the idea of belonging in the book. How do you define what it means to belong? First and foremost, you have to feel that you belong in your own skin and body. It took me a really long time to trust myself, and a lot of us struggle with some of those things. Self-love, self-trust. Ultimately, I don't know that you can ever feel like you truly belong in the community if you don't feel like you belong in your own skin first. So that's really been a quest of mine, because I know that the happier I am, and the more open and confident I feel about myself and who I am, the more I will attract a broader sense of community, and a community that really feeds me instead of just feeds from me. That's ultimately what we all want the most. You write in the book about being arrested as a young girl in connection to street racing and how that reshaped how you thought about the world. How so? It helped me understand what a difference a day can make. You can set off one morning to go to school and end up the next morning in a place you never thought you could be. It helped me understand at a very high level how quickly one can get swept up into the system, especially from making a mistake as a young person. And it also helped me understand that every decision I'm going to make in my life is going to matter. And when I'm given another opportunity, what am I going to do with that opportunity? I don't want to squander it. I often think about being in jail, even though it was short-lived. I think about being there, about how lucky I am to not be there, and about other people who made decisions and found themselves there, and maybe still find themselves there. And I don't know, so often there are so many things that force me into a space of gratitude. What blossomed from the 15th percent pledge is nothing short of incredible. Where do you want to continue to see that grow? And is 15% still the goal? Yes, 15% is absolutely still the goal. We have now placed over 600 Black-owned brands on the shelves of our pledge takers, which is so exciting. For me, it's really about, okay, now that they're there, how do we support them? And also, as consumers, we need to check our own spending and make sure that 15% of our dollars are going to Black-owned brands. Looking at what's in our pantries, refrigerators, closets, laundry rooms, really everywhere. You can't just put someone on the shelf and that's it. They need to be supported. It's been such an incredible journey as a Black entrepreneur myself to be able to make it into certain rooms and not just pull up one seat at the table, but actually start constructing a bunch of different tables within that room. And then also have the people who were at the table with me already also be really excited about welcoming other people into the space. You've had so much success in your life and career, but in the description of your book, it says that none of this came from a drive to succeed. What's the driving factor for you? It's a drive to amplify people who are not just underrepresented, but actually historically excluded. Like the artisans in Africa who've been making these incredible vellies since the very beginning. Like so many of these Black-owned businesses, someone like a Danessa Myricks, who's been a makeup artist for so long and is absolutely crushing it now that she's on the shelves at Sephora. For me, it's about how do we advocate for more opportunity and access for those around me. That's always been my driving why. We're jumping over to work and money, and this article is They Left Careers in the Arts for the Field of Nursing. While reports of nurses quitting are on the rise, we talked to three Columbia Nursing School grads about their choice to join the field during a pandemic. The early months of the COVID-19 pandemic were a frightening time. Some lost friends and loved ones. Some found themselves in unwilling solitude, while others thought they'd never have a moment alone again. People lost their jobs, while still a great number were forced to work at the risk of getting sick. In New York City, the din of ambulance sirens would not let up, a constant reminder of untold suffering. Amid all this darkness and uncertainty, a small window of hope opened every day at 5 p.m., when, in many cities, people banged on pots and pans to give thanks for the superheroes of our new reality, healthcare workers. In our first story for the Pivot column, we celebrate a crop of recent nursing school graduates, newly anointed heroes for the COVID-19 era. Though we are experiencing an ongoing nursing shortage, with a recent report showing that 30% of nurses are still considering leaving the profession, the pandemic has been a catalyst for some to pick up a stethoscope. CU Columbia University's nursing program, which has seen an uptick in admissions since the pandemic began. Within the first 6 months of the pandemic, we were astounded to receive a 30% increase in applications. The phones were ringing off the hook, says Judy Wolf, Senior Associate Dean of Student Affairs at Columbia School of Nursing. Founded in 1892, the Columbia School of Nursing was actually designed with second career hopefuls in mind. In 1990, nearly 100 years later, the school introduced its innovative accelerated program guaranteeing a Master of Science in 15 months. To promote diversity, the program has adopted a new holistic admissions process. This means focusing less on academic records and more on who potential students are, where they come from, and what they value, as well as evidence that they care passionately about vulnerable populations. According to Wolf, the idea of nurses just being for bedside or bedtime care is long expired. In recent years, you'll see that nursing has exploded in local areas, government, education, corporate, it's everywhere. That's why we need people with different skill sets and life experiences. Here, two recent grads and a current student of Columbia's nursing program talk about finding the courage to become a newbie in a totally new career field and what they learned along the way. Pivot lesson. your answer to what would you be doing if not this, do it. From the time she was 16 years old, Avra Messe, M-E-S-S-E, knew she wanted to be a ceramic artist. At 17, she went to one of the country's best undergrad programs for ceramics, followed by a top-tier grad school. By the time she was 23 years old, she was a professor in her field. But after more than 25 years of working in the art world, she decided it was time to pursue the road not taken. She currently works as a nurse in an oncology unit and is in school full-time, getting her doctorate to become a nurse practitioner. I will just say this about the art world. It's very misogynistic. I experienced it my entire career. In undergrad, one of my professors would have polls about which girls were the best looking. When I became a professor, my school always supported the male grads over the women. The galleries were more likely to show male work. I also found it very hard to get back into the art world after I had children. I finally took a job at a lamp company where I made all the glazes and surfaces for the product. When it was time for me to get promoted, they gave it to a 23-year-old guy with no experience. Every day I would come home so miserable from that job. That summer, my wife and I took a road trip to Maine, which turned out to be a long drive with no cell service. So we started playing games. She asked me, "What would you do if you couldn't be an artist?" I've always been interested in medicine. Most of my sculptures reference internal organs and medical devices. I said, "I'd love to be a nurse." By September 1st, I was taking prereqs. I graduated from the Columbia Nursing Program in 2020. 3 days after Columbia got its first COVID case, the university shut down and went remote. Columbia worked out a system with New York Presbyterian for students to work as nurse techs. I learned to wrap bodies immediately. It was just devastating. A death every single day. But I got to feel like I was part of the solution during this global pandemic. I know it's not the voice that you usually hear, but I found it very exciting. I absolutely hit the ground running. I think everyone should do a midlife career change. It's invigorating. I'm excited about my future in this field and so grateful to be part of it. I really love it. I know there's a lot of burnout in this profession because there's short staffing up the wazoo, but I'm still untouched by it. My batteries are fully charged. Pivot lesson. The skills you've honed for years in one field could be what makes you great in another. By the time Tristan Kim had left college in Korea, where he studied French, Japanese, and theater, he had already been cast in many short films, commercials, and TV shows. Kim's work took him to Thailand, where he was part of a K-pop group, which led to an offer to host MTV Thailand. Kim rejected the offer and moved to Hollywood to pursue acting. When the pandemic hit and everything, including the entertainment industry, was put on pause, Kim went from being a performing actor to enrolling at Columbia for nursing. During the pandemic, I was working at a Japanese restaurant, where the staff were like my second family. When the restaurant shut down, there was a sense that we were going through the devastation together. And of course, there was government help. I decided that I needed some financial stability in my life. My dad is an ophthalmologist, and my grandma used to be a pediatrician. I grew up watching them. I think their dedication to helping people really affected me. I had never thought I would get into Columbia Nursing School. I didn't know English up until pretty recently. I worked really, really hard. I remember being very emotional when I got the acceptance letter. My training as an actor had helped me a lot with the nursing program. As actors, we are taught to go deep into our own psychology, understand ourselves, which translates well into understanding others. The more I know myself, the more I can help you. One example is my ability to read nonverbal cues. A patient might say their pain is a 3 out of 10. I look for other cues. Grimaces on the face, or maybe the patient is trembling. That kind of indicates that this patient is in much more pain than they are saying. I love nursing, but I'm not trying to get away from acting. I just don't know when my break is going to come. When I have an acting hiatus, I want to focus on nursing. If I do book something, maybe I can take a leave of absence for a little bit. I want to hold on to both professions because I think both are very beautiful. Pivot lesson. Nothing about life is linear. You have to just go where your heart takes you. Like we say in acting, go before you're ready. Danny Burgess was on tour with a Broadway musical called The Band's Visit when the pandemic hit and his whole life changed. When the show had to shut down in Pittsburgh, Burgos moved back in with his family in Miami. Before getting swept up in the bright lights of musical theater, he had wanted to be a nurse, so he made the leap. In May 2022, he gave the commencement speech at his graduation from the Columbia Nursing Program and now plans on working in community medicine with an emphasis on LGBTQ+ inclusive care. My story starts in 2009 when I graduated high school. I wanted to be a nurse, but I took one anatomy and physiology class in college and it just killed my spirits. I switched my major to musical theater, which had always been really easy for me. Straight out of college, I booked a national tour of Beauty and the Beast, then regional productions of In the Heights. In 2016, I booked On Your Feet, my first Broadway show, and then I got The Band's Visit. If you look at my resume, I'm always the understudy to the lead. I became very negative. I kept going so close to Broadway, they always went with the other guy. I kept telling my friends, I think this is my last show. And then we got to Pittsburgh at the peak of the pandemic. Pretty soon, we were all out of a job. I ended up moving back to Miami at 30 years old, living in my childhood bedroom. Remember how back in the beginning, people were banging pots and pans outside their windows for healthcare workers? That was what first got me thinking. I woke up one morning and decided I was going to finish what I started and take prereqs for nursing. I got to anatomy and physiology, the classes that had broken me, and I got through them. It was really fantastic. So, I started applying to schools. Nothing about life is linear. You have to just go where your heart takes you. Like we say in acting, go before you're ready. You're never going to be ready to make a huge life change. You just slowly but surely do it. And then you look back, and it's a year and a half later, and you're a nurse. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.